Hello, this is Gene Bradley, and you are listening to KBOO Radio, your community radio station in Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. And today in the KBOO studios, our guest is Emma Morris, the author of Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in the Post-Wild World. It's just been published by Bloomsbury USA. Welcome, and thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Now, since 2004, you've been associated with the world's foremost science journal, it says here, Nature.
Right.
That's what it says about itself.
Science might disagree, but it's one of the top two, we'll say.
And you have covered, according to Nature, conservation, biology, energy, agriculture, and film, among other things.
Right.
So that's quite a range.
Yeah, when I started out, I sort of mopped up all the gaps we had in our coverage, so I got a real...
So you're the film critic for Nature.
Yeah, well, that was my own initiative.
Oh, good. Free movies.
Yeah.
Okay. In your afterwards, you acknowledge your writing teacher at Johns Hopkins.
Oh, right.
Who gave you good advice. She said, don't write a book unless you were obsessed with the subject. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got to be obsessed about this subject to the
sure.
point of writing this book?
Yeah. You know, when I started in Nature, there were a lot of subjects going, you know, they felt they didn't have enough depth of coverage in, and one of them was ecology and conservation. And of all the things I picked up, I really took a shine to that. And initially, it was just because I got to go interesting places in the field with these ecologists, so it was really fun. But then I started to sort of notice this interesting shift that was happening in the field where this sort of slow change was taking place, particularly among the younger ecologists, where they were focusing less and less on the past and the history of a certain area and sort of what it was before man messed it up. And they started focusing more and more on what could be done with it or what its future was. But they were a little bit shy about the shift in emphasis. Some of them felt almost as if they were betraying the cause to walk away from these historical baselines. So it was kind of undercover a little bit. And I got really interested in the idea that there was no one perfect Garden of Eden moment in the past that we can look to as the correct state for any piece of nature. And that began, you know, sort of all this new research that we're learning about prehistoric peoples and paleoecology and sort of just like the incredible amount of human influence and overall change in the past. You know, there never was this one shining moment where everything was right. So yeah, I became really obsessed with this notion, and I started to become one of those people who every time we went out to dinner, I would launch into this and my husband would sort of think, oh, here we go again. And it was at that point I realized, you know, I should really write a book about this.
How many years did you go out on these field trips with these scientists?
Well, I started in about 04 or 05, somewhere in there, you know, early on. And I went to Society for Conservation Biology meetings and Ecological Society of America meetings. And I did do some of these sort of field visits. I did a story early on, I remember, I think it was 07, about the National Park Service invasive species control teams. And they drive around in these trucks and kind of descend and do these rapid blitzkrieg operations on invasive species. And so, yeah, it's been a while out in the field. It's been a lot of fun.
Because in your book, you have examples from literally all over the world.
Right.
So I assume you've been to a lot of those places.
Yeah, and at a certain period, at a certain point, you know, maybe in about 2008, I started targeting all of my stories at Nature around this theme because it had become my grand obsession. And so I would do a story about Białowieża Forest in Poland, which is considered, you know, sort of advertised as this pristine untouched old growth forest in Europe, the last one.
The primeval woods.
And so I would pitch a story about that so I could go there. And I would pitch a story about this Oostvaardersplassen, this strange savanna in the Netherlands that has been sort of recreated the Pleistocene, because I also, you know, that was part of the overall theme. So I was knitting it together over time. And some of the stuff that was in the book also appeared in a sort of a different form with a slightly different audience in Nature. But some of the on-site reporting I did just for the book, Australia and Hawaii primarily.
Now, in the book, you say that the book is about a new way of seeing nature.
Right.
And you spend the first part of the book talking about the old way, the way that that we're all used to seeing nature. This is a very challenging book, I have to say. It really made me think that I have really sort of taken for granted a lot of principles, if you will, first principles about how things should be, and your book really challenged a lot of those principles. So it wasn't necessarily an easy read to start with. But you talk about, at first, about the notion of a pristine wilderness, and especially in terms of American ecology and conservation and resource management, the notion of a pristine wilderness. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think that especially in the United States and maybe also in Australia to some extent, because the conservation impulse or ethic kind of arose before Europeans had finished dominating the landscape, there was this notion that we had pristine wilderness still on our hands to protect and work with. And that everything that we saw in North America, for example, when Columbus stepped off the boat was a pristine wilderness. Untouched by humanity. Well, yes, of course, there were some indigenous people here, but they did hardly anything. Or another argument was, well, they lived in balance with the land. You know, but you know, the more we learn, the more we see that people, not just recently in the recent past, but in the prehistoric past, thousands of years ago, have made major changes to the landscape. I mean, in North America, there were huge numbers of large mammal species that have been completely driven extinct, most likely by humans, ground sloths and mastodons and cheetahs. And when those animals went, whole landscapes changed in a ecological ripple effect. You know, things that had been savannas became forested and vice versa. Compositions of tree species changed. So the landscape that we saw when we got here really wasn't a pristine wilderness. It was a completely human artifact.
Yeah, but still, there's this notion that's embedded in our thinking about it's an ethical duty to heal a wounded nature. We broke it, we have to fix it.
Right.
That if it not just before the Europeans came, but before anybody was here, that we need to restore it to its natural state.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Paul Martin was a scientist, he died recently, who did a lot of work about these extinctions, and his instinct was, we have to do more work than we thought in order to make good. That the lesson of these big extinctions was that we had to do a lot of work, but extinctions are not easy to come back from, you know, until our cloning technology is much improved. Once you learn about the huge depth of our changes to the landscape, then if you follow that ethic to its logical conclusion, we've totally lost. We cannot make good. We cannot heal these changes. So that way lies despair, and that way does not lie action and enthusiasm towards environmental protection and environmental change. So, but I do think that the impulse that we have to take care of nature is a genuine and a good impulse that we need to continue to have. What's the tweak we need to make is that instead of returning it to a previous stage, what we need to do is we need to take care of it in the present and for the future, and not necessarily looking exactly the way it did at some historical point.
Now, you talk about how most restorative projects and many conservationists try to recreate a former time in their efforts. And you have an example in your book, the Scotia Sanctuary in Australia. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's a fascinating story.
Yeah. So, I mean, Australia has a lot of work to do if they want to get pieces of land back to. Now, their typical baseline is when Europeans arrived, Captain James Cook, and I don't have a date in front of me.
1778 is right. What you told me.
So. Yes, right. So that's their typical baseline is the day Cook stepped off the boat, which, you know, of course, ignores enormous changes that the people who lived there before made to landscape. But setting that aside, let's say you wanted to go back to day one of Cook. The problem is that they have exotic species in Australia have made themselves thoroughly at home, and they're infiltrated all the landscapes, and they've really dug in. So Scotia is out in sort of, I guess it's out in the outback, and it's a very arid landscape, very beautiful landscape with different kinds of eucalyptus trees. And in order to return it to a historical state, they have to remove all of the exotic species. So this means building incredible prison-like fences and then getting a guy to go in and kill every single fox, every single cat, every single bunny rabbit. You know, sometimes they've got goats.
And that took a long time.
A long time, years, a huge undertaking. Poisons, trapping, shooting. These are clever animals. It's an incredible endeavor, and at the end, what you have is you have a little postage stamp in the outback with a huge, high fence around it, and inside, it looks sort of like it did in 1778.
So you say that historically faithful ecosystems are necessarily heavily managed ones.
Yeah, and this really gets at what I think is the most kind of central insight that I had when I was researching this book, which is that we tend to put two concepts together, wilderness, right? So something that's wild, and historical, something that looks like it used to. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, because of climate change, because of species movement, because of all the things that we have done to the landscape, the things that look the most historical are actually the most managed. And so therefore, they're in some ways the least wild. The landscapes that are the most wild and free and uncontrolled look nothing like what we're used to. They're the ones that are teeming with exotic species and rich and diverse and weird and brand new. And we're not comfortable with them yet, but they are pretty wild.
And another of the bedrock beliefs that we have is that nature is unchanging, that there's a balance of nature, an equilibrium, that it's like Yellowstone, everything is in balance, and if you introduce something from the outside or something changes dramatically, everything is thrown out of balance.
Right.
And you talk to scientists who really are of a different opinion, who have come to the belief that there isn't one unique state of natural conditions for any given landscape, but things are constantly changing. So to restore it back to a moment in time is just really one moment in time.
It's arbitrary, yeah.
Yeah, it becomes arbitrary. And you use the Yellowstone model as one of the primary American experiences with trying to develop this thinking. How it's when the first white settler or white trapper or whatever came into the land, and that's right. The way it should look forever, forgetting that it was quite a volatile environment for quite a long time.
Right.
So the second part of your book, you talk about new thinking about nature, new thinking about, and I want to say this carefully, people's role in managing nature.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the concepts is radical rewilding. Pleistocene rewilding, especially. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, Pleistocene rewilding sounds at first like we're really clinging to the past in a more intense way. But it's a little more nuanced than that, because what we're doing is, instead of looking to these historical baselines, which typically are when Europeans showed up, we're going back to really sort of pre-human influence. But in order to do that, we're going back to before a whole bunch of extinctions happened. So we can't bring these animals back. So instead, we could bring back proxy animals, animals that are pretty similar in the way they use the landscape and the way they interact with an ecosystem, but aren't the same exact species. So there have been proposals to do this in the United States. We lost a lot of animals that have similar species living in Africa, elephants, lions. There was sort of an American lion. There was an American cheetah. There were camels in America. And those animals are coincidentally sometimes not doing so well in their own native ranges. So the idea is that a big group of conservationists came up with about 5 years ago is to bring those animals to America, let them loose in carefully controlled conditions, of course, and see what kind of landscape they produce and see if this will give us, will this bring back the pre-human North America?
And you're really talking about reinstituting processes, mm-hmm, by using these proxy animals.
It's a really processed-oriented view. So, for example, in some landscapes, there would have been grazers and then also a different suite of animals that would have nibbled on all the leaves and so on. Sometimes we've lost the leaf nibblers, and sometimes we've lost the grazers, and sometimes we've lost both. Sometimes in landscapes where we don't have bison anymore, we don't have bison wallowing. Bison wallowing creates these nice little depressions that catch moisture and have little micro, mm-hmm, environments. So it's reinstating those kinds of processes of grazing and wallowing and migration. Rather than just let's have a checklist of what species were here and reinstate that checklist.
If you're just joining us, my name is Gene Bradley. This is KBOO Radio 90.7, and today we're talking to Emma Morris about her new book, Rambunctious Garden. You mentioned this a minute ago, but could you tell us a little bit about the experiment in the Netherlands that Frans Vera is working on? It's sort of like this rewilding.
Yeah, it is rewilding, and he's a real visionary, I think, and he's working under particularly tough conditions, in the sense that he's working in the Netherlands, which is one of the most developed and kind of least wild countries on the planet.
Fully used.
Every corner, the farm, they plant out to the corner. So here you have a landscape that is a nature reserve, but instead of just kind of doing what they typically do in European nature reserves, which is to run it using old traditional agricultural methods, what he's done is he's tried to reinstate processes that he believes shaped European landscapes before humans came to dominate them, which are principally grazing and the kind of cycling between grasslands and closed forests. And so there's another school of thought that thinks that Europe was just one enormous closed forest before human domination, but he thinks it was more of like a savanna. So in order to test this out, he's brought in proxies for some of the extinct animals of Europe. There was a big beast there called the auroch, which you might have seen pictures of in cave drawings. It's a big, enormous cattle-like beast. It's the ancestor of cattle. So he's got this line of cattle that have been developed to look as close as possible to the aurochs. And they're big, big beasts. They look, they definitely, you know, they're maybe not quite cave paintings, but they don't look like one you would want to be trapped in a paddock with. And then for the wild horses, he's got a line of horses that are sort of particularly unbred and sort of considered to be quite similar to the wild horses. And then he's got red deer, which I think are the same as our elk, more or less, very similar. And they're out there in this huge, I mean, you know, when you go to visit the place, you go in a big Jeep. It's like you're in Kruger, and you bounce around on the terrain, and there's these huge herds of deer on the horizon, and there's hardly any trees. They're amassing, like, schooling fish, and then there's a huge herd of wild horses, and then right over the shoulder of the wild horses, there's this commuter train, and there's some pylons, and you think, right, I'm in the Netherlands. And in fact, this entire nature reserve is behind a dike, and if they stopped maintaining the dike, it would all be underwater. Yeah. So it's an incredibly paradoxical landscape, because he's stage managed the whole thing. This is his, you know, living diorama of the past. But on the other hand, it's incredibly wild. There's life, there's death, there's migratory birds have showed up and started breeding, especially some kind of rare birds. He got a black vulture showed up from Spain, you know. So he's got this real sense of wilderness and this real vital natural processes, but he's made it all happen, and with domestic animals in some cases. So it's a really shows us that we can do a lot of interesting things beyond just building walls around Yellowstone-like spaces.
And in fact, the nature from outside the reserve is coming into the reserve.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, he sort of set up these conditions, and then he feels vindicated by the fact that he's getting these birds show up, these bird species. He's sort of secretly hoping that some wolves, which are kind of coming back into Europe in larger numbers, will show up, and that will really complete the processes there, because he needs predation to have the whole suite.
Another of the ideas that you talked to these scientists about was the idea of assisted migration. And one example is since 2009, British Columbia has really been the first country or political unit to start moving its trees. Could you tell us how that works?
Well, it's interesting because this was one case in my research where I wasn't talking to ecologists or conservationists. This was a group of scientists who work for forestry. So they've really got a sort of a more straightforward economic motive, which is they want big, tall, straight trees that'll make good timber. And what they've noticed is that they have in place, and most forestry areas do, these seed transfer policies that say you plant the genetic stock that's nearby, because trees are very micro-adapted to certain areas. So you don't want to just plant generic Doug fir seed, because it might do terribly. So instead of planting all the seeds from right where they, right the location where they are, they're going to start planting seeds from just a little bit to the south, with the understanding that because the climate has changed, now these warmer conditions will be, you know, the trees from the south will be better adapted to the current site. So they're not moving species, but they're moving sort of genetic subpopulations, and they're inching them up the province every time they replant in an effort to make sure they've got the most well-adapted trees as possible. And what's interesting about this is that conservationists are not, they're thinking about doing similar things, which is if you have a species that looks like it might be in trouble because of climate change, you could stand there and watch it go wink out and die, or you could actually move the species to a place where it would now be better adapted because the climate has changed. But it's a dicey proposal. It scares a lot of people.
And because there's a strong tradition, as you say, of non-intervention, the notion of moving a species outside its historical range is really...
It's terrifying. Yeah.
I mean, really where people, the road divides here.
And it, you know, because what it does is it puts you in a position of saying, do I let this thing go extinct because of human action? Because climate change is fundamentally a human action. Or do I save it through human action and meddling and basically turn it into a non-native exotic species? I mean, you could argue that that's what you're doing if you take it outside of its historical range. So it really... pits a bunch of our instincts about conservation against each other. Extinctions are bad. Exotic species are bad. Which one's worse?
Right. And in fact, one of the biggest shocks to my system as I was reading this book was what you wrote about invasive species. I mean,
right.
We all, you know, in our DNA, we know about invasive species. We've all pulled the ivy off the trees and all this kind of thing. And you really... talk about a different way of thinking about this. And the chapter is called Learning to Love Exotic Species.
Right.
Could you explain that?
Well, I know, I mean, it seems like a very counterintuitive notion, but and first of all, let me give a caveat here, which is there are certainly some species that are doing things that we don't want in certain spaces. And that, you know, I am not against pulling ivy off the trees.
Okay.
I think that's
on the record.
Yeah.
We don't want to brand you as an ivy lover.
Exactly. But there has been in the field this recent sense that the kind of rhetoric about exotic species, non-native species, calling them invasive species for or at least a subset of them has gone too far. The idea that if any species is outside of its native range, it is sort of a wanted fugitive, dead or alive, let's get it out of there, de facto, is not necessarily going to be the most adaptive attitude in the future. I mean, first of all, we've got climate change coming. If we stand there with, you know, at the border and refuse to let species move, we are preventing them from adapting to climate change, and that's not going to be to their advantage. The second thing is that a lot of species movements are not that disruptive to local ecosystems. Species slot in, the world goes on. In some cases, I talk about whole novel ecosystems, which are made of a bunch of different invasive species or exotic species. And while the purist might prefer a native ecosystem at that site, that's not what's there. And you could spend millions of dollars ripping out every single one and replanting it with natives. Or you could look at it and say, okay, this isn't a parking lot. What can we see that's good here? What's the carbon sequestration profile? Are there any endangered birds that are using this as habitat? And there are, in fact, papers coming out. Just recently, a paper came out about the conservation uses of non-native species, ways that they can be employed to help prevent extinctions and increase biodiversity. So we need to get beyond branding them all as criminals just for being outside of their historical range. And what we need to do is we need to say, what's our goal for this area and how does this species fit in or not fit in with that goal? Right. And make our judgments on that basis.
And this gets back to reconsidering the whole notion of nature and equilibrium, and everything has a start point when everything was perfect.
Right.
And then it got wrecked.
I mean, you see, and it was a beautiful idea, and I can see why it's hard to give up, because the idea was, let's say you want ecosystem services like water filtration, or let's say you want beauty, or let's say you want, you know, any goal you wanted, any goal you could possibly name, it was going to be covered by going back to the historical baseline, mm-hmm. because everything was perfect then. So
right.
You didn't have to worry about it. You always knew what your goal was going to be. And in the new world, when historical baselines have kind of melted away under sort of increased scientific research, now we have to decide what our goals are for every piece of land. And that's tough. That's not easy. So, you know, it's a tougher world out there.
So we as people need to move away from saving the redwoods to really considering how nature's going to work in a world that we have changed.
Yeah. First of all, we need to definitely save the redwoods. You know,
I'm glad to hear they're still on the list.
Yeah. One of the goals that could be on your list could be, so we don't want some places to change. Some places have become culturally special to us and we don't want them to change, and we're willing to invest a lot of resources in those places. Or in Yellowstone, for example, we might be willing to let it change, but we certainly don't want to see it developed or turned into something that's used commercially. So we still need, we very much need large, wild, natural spaces. But what we need to do is expand from that. If all we focus on are our Yellowstones, our Yosemites, and our Redwoods, we are going to miss huge opportunities to do conservation in all the in-between spaces in the whole rest of the world.
The climate is going to change in Yellowstone. It's going to change in Yosemite. Things are going to change there regardless of what kind of walls we put up.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many concepts in your book that you talk about. We just don't have time to talk about all of them. But I do want to spend just a minute on the last part of your book where you give us a menu for new goals.
Right.
Could you just talk briefly about that?
Sure. As I said, I mean, the tricky thing is that now we have to be explicit about what we want from a piece of land. So, and so now we, you know, we sit down and we say, okay, we've got this island and it's used to be used for this. And now we have some opportunities here. Do we want it to be a haven for endangered species? Do we want it to provide ecosystem services? Do we want it to be recreational? So there's a whole list of goals. And in an ideal world, there would be a very democratic process where everybody who had a stake in every piece of land could come together and sort of shape a vision for what the goals for the piece of land could be. This is where the rubber meets the road, and maybe it's going to have to be the subject of my second book because, you know, this means lots of long meetings.
Yes, I see long meetings in our future.
Absolutely. But we have to, we can't just let the world go. We have fundamentally changed every inch of it. And so it is now our responsibility to manage it wisely and to be good to it. I mean, and not to just pave it over and treat it as damaged goods or lost.
The three things you say we have to do, whichever of these menus of new goals we pick, is be open about the costs, which is not in the tradition of conservation.
Right.
Preserve open land every time we have an opportunity, and to try everything.
Absolutely. You know, if there is a little piece of land out behind the big box store and you could either put in 5 more parking spaces or you could leave it as it is and so some birds could nest there and some bugs could hang out there, that's worth doing. There are opportunities literally everywhere. Concrete isn't forever either. Every place on the world could be better for conservation. It isn't an all or nothing game.
So at the end of this book, at the end of thinking about this for these years and talking to these scientists, do you feel optimistic?
Yes, I do. Because I think that I have this image in my head of a future where our cities just look a little bit more wild around the edges and there's more wildlife in them. And, you know, maybe we're scratching bug bites more often on our bike rides to work, but nature has infiltrated the cities. But that also we're conscious about how we're managing our natural spaces and we've decided what we want from them and we're moving forward. And we're not just mourning all of the time what we're losing.
I have been talking with Emma Morris, who's written an incredibly important book, Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in the Post-Wild World. And I really encourage everybody to go out and get a copy of this from your local bookseller, because this is a book that really talks about the changes we need to make and the paradigms that we have held so dear for so long about nature and our relationship with it. Thank you very much for coming into KBOO, and we look forward to seeing you next time with your new book.
Ah, my pleasure.
Okay, thanks again.